Ezekiel 32, a lamentation for Pharaoh. This sixth prophecy against Egypt was delivered some 19 months after the fall of Jerusalem. So Egypt, by this time, which is 585 BC, had shown herself to be a broken reed to Zedekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, having provided no protection against the forces of Nebuchadnezzar. Although, as already mentioned, Nebuchadnezzar was prevented by his preoccupation with Tyre from going directly into Egypt to crush the power of Pharaoh, yet the removal of the buffer kingdom of Judah had taken out of his way an important obstacle to the conquest of Egypt. The doom of Egypt was certain, and in anticipation of this, the prophet is now bidden to take up a lamentation for Pharaoh to emphasize the certainty of his destruction. Verse 2, which begins the lamentation, presents a contrast, the sense of which is brought out very clearly in Rotherham's translation. The young lion of the nations, thou didst deem thyself, whereas thou wast like the crocodile in the seas. This imagery had already been introduced in chapter 29. Instead of the noble, invincible lion that Pharaoh set out to be when he marched to Carchemish to confront the emerging power of Babylon, he had demonstrated himself to be the crocodile. The Authorized Version has whale, the Revised Version has dragon. And regarding the word Nile, the seas in verse 2 is a word applicable to any great water whose activities among the rivers of the lesser nations had served only to trouble the waters as a crocodile thrashing around stirs up mud. The time of judgment on Egypt was approaching. God would take the dragon in his net, cast him forth upon the open field, and leave the carcass as a prey to the nations. Who were represented by the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the whole earth? There may possibly be here an allusion back to the destruction of Pharaoh's hosts in the Red Sea at the time of the Exodus, concerning which the psalmist declared, "Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness." It is also possible that the prophecy contains an allusion to the superstitions of the pagan world at that time, which have been left on record in Babylonian writings. Marduk, the god of the city of Babylon, was believed to have gone forth to battle with the chaos monster, the dragon Tiamat, after a long and fierce battle to have captured the dragon in a net and killed him. And the fate of Tiamat was to be the fate of the power of Egypt. If this is the case, then there is in these words of Ezekiel an allusion to this pagan teaching, then here is an Old Testament precedent for the way in which Jesus based his teaching in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus upon the superstitions of his contemporaries. The fate of Pharaoh's Egypt is again in these verses being compared to the fate of Assyria. That nation too was said to be given to the fowls of the heaven and all the beasts of the field. And this is reinforced by the words which follow, "And I will lay thy flesh upon the mountains and fill the valleys with thy height." And this conveys the extent of Egypt's desolation, so complete that it would figuratively cover the mountains and fill the valleys. The destruction of the power of Egypt is presented now in verse 7 in a different figure, but one familiar to Bible students. Political powers are frequently spoken of as consisting of a heavens, that is the rulers, and an earth, that is the ruled. And the collapse of a kingdom is presented as the darkening of the heavens. Find that in Isaiah 13 and 34. Thus, following the RV, the extinguishing of Pharaoh's, that is, Amasis' power, is represented as the clouding of Egypt's sun, moon, and stars, bringing political darkness over the land of Egypt. Verses 9 and 10 speak of the international repercussions that would necessarily follow the fall of such a power as Egypt. The explanation starts at verse 11. The one who would cause the dragon to be taken up in the net and bring about the darkness of the Egyptian heavens would be the God of Israel, and the instrument in his hands would be Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And this invasion of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar has been discussed on a number of occasions in the consideration of these prophecies against Egypt. There's no need to repeat the points already covered. However, there may be more than Nebuchadnezzar's invasion in mind here. The invasion by Nebuchadnezzar was to bring desolation on Egypt for 40 years. It's 29th chapter, verse 12. But here, a more prolonged period of desolation appears to be in view, for concerning the waters in which Pharaoh, like the crocodile, thrashed around, it is said, neither shall the foot of man trouble them any more. And with this in mind, we may now compare these verses 11 and 12 with chapter 26, verses 7 to 14. In that prophecy concerning the overthrow of Tyre, we saw that Nebuchadnezzar was to commence the work of Tyre's desolation. He shall slay with the sword, he shall break down thy towers, but others were to finish the work that he had started. They shall make a spoil of thy riches, and they shall lay thy stones and thy timber and thy dust in the water. And this referred to the subsequent invasions of Tyre, commencing with that by Alexander the Great. So, here, Nebuchadnezzar was to commence the work. The sword of the king of Babylon shall come upon thee, verse 11, but then by the swords of the mighty will I cause thy multitude to fall. They shall spoil the pomp of Egypt. The work commenced by Nebuchadnezzar was continued by Cambyses, the Persian king, who ruthlessly crushed the attempt of Pharaoh Psammetichus III to break free of foreign domination. As earlier noted, the Persians then, with their own appointed kings on the throne of Egypt, adopted a beneficent attitude to the Egyptians. Troubled times soon followed, so troubled in fact that the invasion of Egypt by Alexander the Great in 332 BC came as a great relief to most Egyptians. And this resulted in a long succession of 15 Ptolemaic kings who were Greek in blood and culture. Thus, Egypt was subjected to tremendous Greek influence, so that its cities and a great deal of rural Egypt too became Hellenic in outlook. And Egypt fell to the Romans in 30 BC, and subsequently it came under Arab and Turkish domination. Even the language of Egypt disappeared, being displaced first by Greek and then by Arabic. The ancient Egypt of the pharaohs is no more. The verses that follow convey the extent of Egypt's political desolation and have to do with Egypt as a political power, not with literal animals and water. aptly represented by many waters that were agitated by animals and man, that is, the scene of great political strife and upheaval, the waters representing Egypt were to become deep, or, more correctly, as in the Revised Version, clear. No longer turbulent and muddy, the sediment of political agitation, especially that caused by the crocodile, having settled, the waters would become still and would run like oil, tranquil, slow and silent, and so would Egypt's political life decline as a result of the activities of the terrible of the nations, verse 15. There's a footnote here that the word clear in the RV literally means to sink down, to subside. There is therefore another way of looking at this verse. There may be here the idea of the evaporation of Egypt's power. That is, her waters were drying up and sinking in their channels. And compare that with the drying up of the Euphratian power in Revelation 16. The effect of the outpouring of judgment upon Egypt would be to let men know that I am the Lord. Now, this is a recurring statement in Ezekiel's prophecies. Israel was to come to know that I am the Lord as the result of God's judgments falling on them. Ammon, Moab, the Philistines, Tyre were all to be brought to the realization that I am the Lord. This is to say that as the result of the judgments poured upon them, Yahweh's word would be vindicated. The God of Israel would be shown to be the one who could declare the things that are to come hereafter. Isaiah 41. It is a phrase that had special relevance to the Egyptians, for it was of the Egyptians at the time of the Exodus that God first declared, I will lay my hand upon Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. This does not mean that they began to worship the true God, but that they were forced by circumstances to admit that Yahweh was stronger than all their idols. Now, verse 16 reminds us that this prophecy, as already stated in verse 2, is a lamentation for Pharaoh as representative of the Egyptian power. Egypt's downfall would have repercussions in surrounding nations, and these nations are likened to professional mourning women, lamenting the demise of this great power. Verse 17 begins a section regarding Egypt's shame in Sheol. This section of Ezekiel's prophecy is the last of the seven prophecies against the nation of Egypt. And as we have considered the previous six oracles, we've come to appreciate the importance of the fall of Egypt at the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. It's a fact which receives but scant attention in the records of profane history. The history of ancient Egypt really ends with this invasion of Nebuchadnezzar. One historian, speaking of the history of Egypt subsequent to Nebuchadnezzar's invasion, had this interesting comment. It's J.H. Breasted, A History of Egypt, as quoted by W.M. Smith in Egypt and Biblical Prophecy, page 118. It runs like this. The fall of Egypt and the close of her characteristic history were already an irrevocable fact long before the relentless Cambyses knocked on the doors of the Pelusium. The Saitic state was a creation of the rulers who looked into the future, who belonged to it and had little or no connection with the past. They were as essentially non-Egyptian as the Ptolemies who followed the Persians. The Persian conquest in 525 BC, which deprived Psammetich, the third son of Amasis, of his throne and kingdom was but a change of rulers, a purely external fact, and if a feeble burst of national feeling enables this or that Egyptian to thrust off the Persian yoke for a brief period, the movement may be likened to the convulsive contractions which sometimes lend momentary motion to limbs from which conscious life has long departed. With the fall of Psammetich III, Egypt belonged to a new world, towards the development of which she had contributed much, but in which she would no longer play an active part. Her great work was done, and unable, like Nineveh and Babylon, to disappear from the scene, she lived on her artificial life for a time under the Persians and the Ptolemies, ever sinking till she became merely the granary of Rome, to be visited as a land of marvels by wealthy Greeks and Romans. We've quoted at length from this writer because, on the one hand, he confirms the accuracy of Ezekiel's prophecies against Egypt in asserting that the great turning point in Egypt's history was pre-Persian, that is, as a result of the Babylonian invasion. And on the other, he presents Egypt becoming unconscious and sinking, as it were, into the grave of history, thus demonstrating the appropriateness of the prophet's language in the section before us. Sheol, the grave. In the English language, we use the word grave in two senses, related but nevertheless distinct in meaning. We speak of a grave, by which we mean a hole in the ground, which a dead body is buried. Then we speak of the grave, by which we mean the ultimate destiny of all men. Whether a man is buried, burnt, or lost in outer space, we say he's gone to the grave. The Hebrew language has different words for these two things, and the word Sheol, rendered hell here in Ezekiel, equates with our use of grave in the general sense, the second of our two meanings. Sheol is used of individuals and of nations. The Bible teaching about Sheol and the individual is plain. Those in Sheol are silent, are unconscious, and apart from bodily resurrection remain there. Therefore, anyone appealing to Ezekiel 32 in support of a belief in the popular concept of souls in hell should be asked to explain such statements as, which are gone down to hell with their weapons of war, verse 27, and they have set her a bed in Sheol, in the midst of the slain. Ezekiel is not speaking of the descent of individuals into Sheol. He is speaking of nations in Sheol, and in so doing is using a way of speaking of the fall of great powers and cities, which is frequent in the pages of Scripture. Nations and individuals are both referred to by the psalmist when he says, the wicked shall be turned into hell, that is Sheol, and all the nations that forget God. Already in chapter 31, Ezekiel has spoken of the fall of the Assyrian power using the same figure. In the day when he went down to the grave, that is Sheol, I caused a mourning. Isaiah speaks of the fall of Babylon in a similar way, in Isaiah 14. And in the New Testament, where Hades is the Greek word equivalent to the Hebrew Sheol, Jesus himself used the same figure when he predicted the fall of the Galilean towns which rejected him. Thou, Capernaum, which art exalted unto heaven, shall be brought down to hell. So, we have now Pharaoh's tour of Sheol, and this section of Ezekiel is easily understood when seen against this background. Pharaoh, representing the power of Egypt, has taken on an imaginary tour of this national Sheol, the grave of history. He sees the mighty nations of the past which rose to greatness, exercised terror in the land of the living, verse 23, and then crashed to ruin. In turn, he is shown Asshur, the mighty power of Assyria, which had fallen to the Babylonians around 612 BC. And he's shown Elam, the nation known from the time of Abraham for its warlike spirit, which had been subdued by Ashurbanipal in 650 BC. Meshech and Tubal, the warlike peoples descended from Japheth, that profane history records as troubling Assyria on her northern border. These two Pharaoh would see in Sheol, for the RV margin is surely correct when it renders verse 27 as an interrogative. Shall they not lie with the mighty, which are gone down to hell? And finally, Edom, the princes of the north and the Zidonians. All these powers too are seen prostrate in the national Sheol. The word of God had gone forth from the prophet, decreeing the fall of Egypt. The fall was therefore certain. And the only consolation of facing the power of Egypt at this time, verse 31, was the fact that she was following the path trodden by all the powers of history. And there is a certain irony in speaking thus of Egypt. There has been no power in history that has given more attention to the burial of its kings and preparation for their supposed afterlife. But shame in Sheol was the divine decree for Egypt and the pharaohs, to be brought about by Nebuchadnezzar, as we have discussed at length.